Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So John Hockenberry of The Takeaway has been on a power trip all this week. Those who know John may say that's not really news. No, just kidding. Power Trip is a series he just completed out west, looking at the cutting edge of alternative energy development. And we asked John to do a kind of power trip coda by coming on with us because there was just so much interesting stuff there beyond the usual yes or no debate on global warming. So, John Hockenberry, I know it's like midnight now on your crazy morning show schedule, so thanks for staying up and doing this with us.
Oh, no problem. I'm headed to the airport, so I had to be awake anyway. And I'm still just marveling over derived from fenugreek from your blogger last guest. That is so great, Brian.
Can you put...
I love your show so much.
Can we put fenugreek in the gas tank? That's what I want to know.
You know, if there was a way to do it, there's somebody out here on this power trip adventure that we've been on that's doing it. I mean, what we've discovered, you asked before the break, did I find the holy grail of what the future energy technology is? No, because the answer to the question is there is no holy grail. There are just thousands and thousands of little grail-lets, basically small technology bets in a whole variety of areas that exactly mirror the myriad changes that all of us in the developed and developing world are going to have to make in the way we live to achieve the energy efficiency that's going to allow us a sustainable existence on the planet. And the technology is moving in all directions at once. It's a fascinating dynamic.
So some of the interesting ones, let's take one, and some of them sound almost too simple to be true, like getting power from algae, you reported on. We generally think of algae as an irritant, something that mucks up our favorite lake or fish tank.
Well, it's also the case that algae is the most efficient producer of biomass on the planet. It's one of the oldest creatures, of course, on the planet, and it's open to genetic engineering so you can tag algae DNA with the propensity, for instance, to acquire oil. In other words, the algae cells can be filled with oil that can be refined and then used as a biofuel. The problem with algae, though, is that it's an irritant. Why? Because it grows on the top of water, and when it proliferates, it basically blocks out light to everything below. So to actually grow on any sort of commercial scale algae, you need a Lake Erie-sized plantation. So this company that we were investigating up in the Seattle area is figuring out how to get light down deep in the water to basically have vertical plantations of algae so you can grow it at the top layer of a body of water, the middle, and the bottom. And it's an interesting sort of physics and chemistry and biology. And, the idea that we're going to be able to refine algae into biofuels like diesel fuel is becoming a practical reality. That's just one example.
I really like the interview with Joe Pilastri, co-founder of the Scintilla Corporation, who kind of deconstructed the power use meters that we all have in our homes. Usually they're in the basement and they show readings in kilowatt hours that we barely understand. What's the alternative?
Well, Joe makes a really interesting point. He says, the reason you don't know anything about your energy consumption is because the meter on your house isn't talking to you as it's supposed to. Who's it talking to? It talks to the utility, and it has one message. And the message is, look how much money we're making off this sucker in this house. He's got a device, a black box, that does exactly the opposite, a meter that talks to the consumer on an appliance-by-appliance level that can be networked into a wireless web array that basically allows everything that consumes energy in your house to report to the network and tell who the offenders are and who the efficient sort of users are, and you can begin to modify your behavior accordingly. But the amazing thing is what works in a room, works in a house, works in a neighborhood, works on a scale of 100 million.
We got a post on our Uncommon Economic Indicators page from somebody whose story was that they were actually considering unplugging their refrigerator and going refrigeratorless. And I think a lot of people know that the refrigerator is probably the most energy-consuming appliance in the home for most people on most days. But we really have no idea how much the computer takes when it's active, how much it takes when it's hibernating. Should you really turn it off at night, which some people say don't bother to do because it hurts the computer more than it actually sucks energy. We don't really know how much the toaster oven takes, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be quite an advance.
It would be. And, you know, computers are no different than toaster ovens in the sense that their design and their engineering occurred at a time when we assumed energy was cheap and basically free. And we're discovering that every appliance has its cost. And we connected a space heater to one of Joe's meters. And the website sort of indicating how much money we were spending quickly went from 63 cents to $1,700 on a yearly average.
Whoa. How difficult is a system like that to set up?
Well, it's trivial to set up. The problem is the boxes that Joe is making cost about $200 each. So until he gets an economy of scale, a manufacturing base where he's producing millions of them, the cost is not going to come down. And he's beginning, interestingly enough, with high-tech companies who have these giant data centers full of servers that desperately need to control their power. He gets Google and Yahoo and a lot of these data server companies like Cisco to buy these, and all of a sudden the price comes down for people like us.
So I see a pattern here already. With the algae, you have a vision of possibilities, a mechanical way that it could work, but a big obstacle, which is that you need all this water because algae kills lakes, basically. And with this, you could attach a box to each appliance to tell how much energy we're sucking, but each box costs $200 right now in its current stage of development. So this kind of ties together what you're seeing as early stage invention on this trip.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, there's a cost of entry, and then there's an economy of scale trajectory where things begin to proliferate to the point that the cost competes with the fossil fuels. I mean, everybody said on this trip that the fundamental problem is getting renewable fuels to be able to compete with the cheap fossil fuels like coal, and increasing the real cost of using coal so that the price we pay for electricity actually reflects the total cost of coal, which includes the destruction of mountains in West Virginia and Tennessee, floods of tailings at the Tennessee Valley Authority. Those kinds of costs are not reflected in coal. When that comes up and the renewables come down, they're going to meet at a threshold point, and maybe you could call that the Holy Grail.
You've been popping around California in a special car on this trip, right?
Up in Oregon, we had a biodiesel car, and we actually, you know, put a little Wesson oil, a little safflower oil in there. We actually thought about getting the hotel to give us their fryer oil so that we could use it one morning, but we just used that up in Seattle.
It didn't smell like maple syrup then, did it?
No, it didn't smell like maple syrup. Although, you know, the one thing about biodiesel is you can eat the fuel if you want to. And I kind of challenged people to do that when we were up there. But, you know, the really great thing about this trip is that people who use renewables produce a kind of a karmic smile. We saw this biodiesel garbage truck and we were going, that's great. And we were asking everybody on the takeaway this week, what makes you mad when you see people wasting energy? Mm-hmm. And we got zillions of stories, all kinds of people telling all kinds of things like, don't use the regular doors when it's cold. Use the revolving doors. That makes me so mad. This is definitely moving into the center stage of people's minds.
Yeah, but you also had a guest. I mean, when we get concerned about each little transgression here, you had a guest this morning who was basically saying, oh, please, it doesn't matter if we get really compulsive about our own energy use, like tearing off one sheet of toilet paper instead of two was his example, because it's only really four big things that are responsible for the dangerous levels of carbon emissions. And I didn't catch what four things he said they were.
You hit the nail on the head. Vinod Khosla, who's a venture capitalist who basically is in a position to make the investments, he had it right this morning. You know, people talk about little things, but in the industrialized world, most people aren't doing what it is that in the industrial world they have the option of saving energy on. The four problems in carbon are steel, cement, oil, and coal. We solve those problems, and we solve this sort of energy crisis. And people love to talk that way down here, but it's really interesting to see the problem just put in its simplest form. And one of the pitches he got recently was from a surgeon who understands how to make cement to stitch bones together. He said he could come up with a process to turn carbon into calcium carbonate glue, which is a building material. So suddenly you'd have carbon waste being used to produce building materials in places like Nigeria, which have oil right there. All of a sudden you have a loop of waste and an energy stream working together, and it's not causing an increase in the carbon footprint on the planet at all.
Of those four, oil and coal, I obviously get. The other two, steel and cement. We just have 15 seconds, but how does steel, say, contribute to global warming?
Steel, massive use of energy. Cement, massive use of fresh water.
All right. John, hey, a radio guy, he knows how to do an answer in 15 seconds. John Hockenberry, co-host of The Takeaway. Have a good trip home, John. Get some sleep.
Thanks, Brian. See you next week.
And he's been in California, which makes it even weirder. If you get into work for a morning show at 4 a.m. New York time, that means you're getting in at 1 a.m. out there. I don't even want to think about it. Maybe he should consider moving to the Middle East to do The Takeaway from now on. All right. Megan Ryan, Lisa Allison, and Jody Abergon produced this program with Paige Cowart and Kate Hines. The executive producer is Nuala McGovern, and that's Debbie Fountain at the audio controls. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer.